Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIES China Energy Program. My name is Anders Hovey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. On the 8th of August, 2023, the China Program published an issue of the Oxford Energy Forum on the geopolitics of energy and China. This podcast is a part of a series drawing on the rich OEF contributions. The aim of the forum was to think about China's role in the geopolitics of energy, both fossil fuels and new energy supply chains, both from China's perspective and the view from other regions around the world. Today's podcast, the fifth in our series, features two contributions. The first, from the article Financing Net Zero Transition for Developing Countries, China's Dilemma in a Fragmenting World, with Chen Ji, who authored the article together with colleague Jiang Shurui. Chen Ji is Executive Director at the China International Capital Corporation, CICC Global Institute. And the second is Carbon Pricing with Yan Qin, Lead Carbon Analyst at Refinitiv and also Research Associate at OIES. Chen Ji, welcome to the OIES podcast.
Hello, Anders.
To set the stage, could you tell us a little bit about the energy transition financing gap in the developing world and why geoeconomic fragmentation worsens that gap?
That's a very good question, Anders. And this is exactly our paper addressed. Achieving net zero transition for developing countries really requires significant investment in clean energy. According to the IEA, the International Energy Agency, to ensure the world is on track to meet 2050 target of net zero emissions, developing countries would require over $1 trillion US dollar in clean energy investment per year by 2030. In contrast, between 2015 and 2023, clean energy investment in developing countries, excluding China, ranged from 214 billion US dollar to 215 billion US dollar per year. A significant financing gap does exist, which will eventually impede global progress towards achieving Paris Agreement climate goal. So geoeconomic fragmentation, as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, describes, in the tendency of globalization to slow or even reverse, is making it even more difficult for developing countries to close this investment gap. This is primarily due to three features that increase international financial costs. Number one, the disruptions to international payment systems. Geoeconomic fragmentation directly results in financial restrictions, including the freezing of financial assets or investment activities, and in extreme cases, shutting down a cross-border payment communication protocol, such as the removal of select Russian banks from SWIFT. These restrictions lead to higher cost of international investment transactions and reduced volume of cross-border payments. And the second feature of this tendency is the reversal of cross-border capital. Investors may allocate less capital to countries that are less aligned on foreign policy issues for reasons that include financial constraints that increase the transaction cost, information asymmetry, a general mistrust, and a fear of expropriation. Price volatility is the third feature I would like to highlight. Increased geopolitical tensions could lead to disruptions to commodity markets, which in turn cause higher inflation and justify tightening of monetary policy. This could depress asset prices, raising borrowing costs for non-financial corporations. So the impact of geoeconomic fragmentation on financing costs is particularly pronounced for developing countries, as evidenced by the substantially large increase in financing costs resulting from geopolitical tension compared to developed economy. And higher financial costs impedes a developing country's ability to attract domestic capital for their clean energy sectors. As a result, developing countries are likely to become even more dependent on international capital.
So Chenzi, China has long been a major financier and investor in the developing world. But in your paper, you discuss how there's really a shift underway in Chinese investment. Is that helpful for the energy transition?
Yes, as you correctly pointed out, China is one of the top investors in developing countries' clean energy initiatives. China's foreign direct investment, FDI, in the clean energy sector accounted for 6% of the total FDI received by developing countries between 2013 and 2022, making it one of the largest investors for developing countries' clean energy sectors. And I believe that there were at least three drivers to drive further growth of China's investment in this area. And number one driver is that stopping overseas coal-fired power plant project frees up more space for clean energy financing. In September 2021, China committed to stopping support for building new coal-fired power projects overseas. And the second driver, I believe, is a growing demand for new energy minerals. Those drive investment in developing countries with rich mineral resources. And the third driver, is a growing market uncertainty brought by the industrial and trade policies from the growing number of economies such as US and Europe, which are pushing Chinese manufacturers to deploy production abroad. US and European countries have implemented green industrial policies for the clean energy sector, such as subsidies for domestic lithium and PV industry and tariffs on related import products from China.
Just to recap, three reasons why China's financing is shifting in the developing world. Number one, that the low coal pledge really opens up more channels for financing clean energy. Number two, the growing interest in minerals, especially for new energy vehicle batteries. And three, diversifying supply chains to supply markets in Europe and North America from countries other than China as part of the global de-risking movement. So as a final question, how is geoeconomic fragmentation leading to increased investment in supply chains in the global South? And is this helpful for the energy transition, or is it actually leading to inefficiencies or tensions? What are the challenges there?
While there's a growing impetus for China to provide more financing to developing countries for clean energy, particularly in the new energy minerals and manufacturing, the changing global landscape presents at least two challenges, which are impeding Chinese institutions from doing so. First, being overly concerned about supply security may, speeding up the fragmentation risk for the new energy mineral market. In recent years, there has been a growing emphasis on supply chain security in new energy minerals as a response to geoeconomic fragmentation. It is acknowledged that international trade and FDI liberalization enhanced productivity and economic growth. However, overly protecting supply chain security has led to increased investment and trade barriers, which have imposed a greater transaction cost on China's financing to developing countries. And second, the escalation of international trade restrictions will impose higher costs for China's investment in clean energy manufacturing sectors in developing countries. For example, the US government has conducted the anti circumvention investigation against the solar PV products from four Southeast Asian countries, which may lead to restrictions on the product exports countries. Manufacturers in those countries would encounter constraints and may be compelled to recalibrate their supply chains and production process to adhere to the potential U.S. anti-circumvention requirements. So I think, you know, these two factors are the main challenges that China has been facing.
All right. So there is a helpful shift in China's investment patterns that will basically help accelerate that energy transition, but counterbalanced by some very important challenges. Chen Ji, I want to thank you very much for joining the podcast today and also for your excellent OEF contribution. So turning to the topic of carbon prices and the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, or CBAM, we're speaking with Yan Qin, lead carbon analyst at Refinitiv and also research associate at OIES. Yan is the author of The Impacts of the EU Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism on China's Supply Chain and China's Response in this issue of the Forum. Yan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
First, I want to note that we also interviewed Yan in more detail about the CBAM back in March 2023. That episode, which you can search for, is entitled, Can the EU's Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism Accelerate Progress on China's Emissions Trading System? Yan, just so we don't repeat too much of the background from before, could you give us a couple of the key dates on the CBAM timeline? When will it be ready? When will it really come into effect? 2026 is the key year, correct?
Yes, I mean, we have a chart on the timeline in the OEF article. But in short, in May this year, so the EU approved the final CBAM legislation, which becomes the world's first green tariff as such. Well, this October, already in 2.5 months' time, so the CBAM will enter its trial period. But as you said, 2026 is really the key year when this scheme will officially launch and exporters to the EU, they have to pay for the CBAM certificates, the carbon costs. Well, of course, there's still a mountain of work ahead for the EU to really implement this scheme. I call it a huge carbon accounting exercise. So before the summer, the EU released one draft on the reporting rules for CBAM just for consultation. Well, at least a dozen more these kind of regulations or drafts will be released in the next years. So stay tuned.
And if 2026 is the key year for when it comes into effect, but then there's also other sectors that could be included later, correct?
Yeah, exactly. It's an evolving process.
Now, you write that the impact of CBAM on China will be limited. Why is that?
Well, the background is that even though, I mean, China is the largest partner for EU imports of goods in 2022, and so roughly 20.8% share according to Eurostat data. So EU CBAM will bring additional costs to China's exports of certain goods already soon. But in the paper, I emphasize this as limited. This is really mainly considers the initial scope of CBAM. So at the start, it's really just aluminium and steel exports from China that will be affected. And these are roughly 3% of China's total export value to the EU in 2022. And this is estimated by researchers as China's Ministry of Commerce. Well, the additional carbon cost, just say for these two sectors, are roughly 100 million euros per year, if we assume a European carbon price of 80 euros. Well, again, even though the initial impact's limited, CBAM is not static and its scope will likely expand later this decade. More sectors, indirect emissions, and maybe more downstream products. When that happens, so the additional carbon costs will be larger. I mean, for example, the same researchers from the ministry, I mean, they estimated, okay, if CBAM will cover, let's say, chemicals or plastics, it will affect another 6% of China's export to the EU. And total carbon costs will increase by another 700 million euros per year. Well, I mean, adding a lot of numbers I mentioned, but adding these numbers up. So in the year 2030, it's likely that Chinese exporters, they may need to pay nearly 1 billion carbon tariff to the EU. And I myself is a carbon market analyst. European carbon price will hit nearly 150 euro in 2030, according to our forecast. So the cost is not, it's small at the start, but it could balloon in, let's say, 10 years' time.
That cost would certainly go down if the price made things uncompetitive for the imports.
Yes, exactly. It'll be passed through.
On the topic of geopolitics, China's opposition to CBAM is strong and also unlikely to change. But how does that affect climate diplomacy and alignment with other countries outside of the EU CBAM? I'm sure other countries share China's opposition. Does this mainly have an effect on diplomacy? And then are there maybe also trade impacts of the opposition to CBAM?
Yeah, it's a very interesting and also very broad question. Well, I mean, CBAM is seen as a green trade barrier by many countries, I mean, specifically developing countries. And as in the OEF article, I mentioned the BRICS statement. So the geopolitical impacts will remain for this scheme. I mean, China officially will keep its opposition to CBAM, as you said, and also the multilateral approach in climate talks. But what is interesting is that, again, climate alignment, as you said, we can already observe a new grouping of countries based on their responses to the EU CBAM. I think some countries, the UK, US, Canada, even Japan and South Korea, they follow the EU, and some of them want to implement its own carbon tariff, or some of them want to form a green products alliance. Well, on the contrary, developing countries, India and African countries, they've criticized CBAM, and they probably continue to do so, and criticize CBAM as discriminatory trade barrier. So I assume that these groupings, they will likely be the same alliance we can observe in climate talks, for example, the upcoming COP28 later this year. Well, regarding the trade flows, no doubt CBAM will have impacts. Well, it's quite complicated. I'm not a trade expert. But I assume that very soon we might see exporters to the EU adjusting their products flows. I mean, for example, start to export or be prepared to export the greener products to the EU and the more carbon intensive ones to countries with less strict climate rules.
Could be a different type of leakage in that case.
Yeah, exactly.
How does the official Chinese climate diplomacy view of CBAM differ, or maybe the coloration is just slightly different in terms of the stance or activity of individual companies in these affected sectors?
Very good point. In fact, the different attitude from the official stance and the Chinese enterprises are really what emphasized a lot in both the previous podcast and the recent OEF paper. Well, this is really based on what I've observed and also heard from talks with the enterprises. The exporters are very eager to prepare for the CBAM, and they want to be ready for the full implementation in 2026. I mean, from this perspective, as we know that one of the objectives of the EU CBAM is really to encourage more countries to adopt ambitious climate policies and speed up industry decarbonization, then I think CBAM is at least fitting for this purpose already. Because, I mean, as the previous podcast mentioned, CBAM is already encouraging more progress in China's establishment of the national ETS and its sector coverage. And now CBAM also makes enterprises, Chinese exporters, realize that their products need to be competitive in a low-carbon world. And the industrials, they need to act faster to decarbonize. So I think this is quite positive. And this will also contribute to China's achievement of its own climate goals.
Rather optimistic take. That's good to hear. Well, Jan, thank you so much. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today, but there's many more insights in the article, of course. Thank you for joining me, and thank you for the contribution to the forum.
Thank you.
A reminder to our listeners that the Oxford Energy Forum on China and the Geopolitics of Energy is available on our website. We hope you'll enjoy reading it and listening to the other podcast episodes on this fascinating topic.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.